everyone, and welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and my guest today is Alyssa Battistoni. We're here talking about her new book, Free Gifts, and wait, let me get this right, Capitalism and the Politics of Nature. All right, did I write it down correctly?
You did, yeah.
All right, Alyssa, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me on the podcast. Great to be here. So I am a political theorist. I teach political theory at Barnard College. And this book really started as, so it was originally my dissertation for my PhD and then kind of evolved quite a lot over the years. I've rewritten it many times. But I would say it actually emerged out of thinking about one of the chapters in particular. So there's a chapter on reproductive labor in the book. And that was that chapter, which is now sort of one chapter, was originally sort of the origin point of the book. And it basically came out of me thinking about, you know, I work on environmental and climate politics, but also on Marxist feminism, feminist thought, and sort of, you know, political economy more broadly. The book came out of this for me, a recognition and thinking about the sort of parallel positions of unwaged housework, domestic labor, reproductive labor, some of the sort of longstanding analysis and critique of Marxist feminist thought about sort of the place of reproductive labor in capitalism, and recognizing sort of the parallels to, what people talk about as like the work of nature, sort of ecosystemic processes and, natural processes that are, sort of fundamental for reproducing and regenerating life on Earth, both human and non-human, but, not economically valuable. And so I started out sort of thinking about that, and that kind of led me down this rabbit hole of trying to ask, well, what's going on here? Why are these both sort of sites of non-value within capitalism? And that was sort of the genesis of thinking about this problem of what I describe as the free gift of nature.
Okay, so, I've got questions, and one of them is talking through the free gift of nature. I mean, I've got questions written down, but I already have another one, so I'm going to go
great
off my script, which is I've been following over the past few years this just thrilling, it seems to me, like revaluation of this progressive, or it's meant to be progressive, narrative that having children is destructive to the environment. That if you have kids, you're somehow unleashing this terrible force of destruction on the world, as if it's not the capitalist states and the corporate, why is it that people seem to have glommed on, well-meaning left-leaning people will be castigating parents for destroying the world? Does this fit into the, I don't remember seeing this come up, but as you're talking about this idea, and I have so appreciated the people who have been writing recently against this idea that no, people who have children are not all possessed with this desire to destroy the world, but that's how it's talked about in some environmental circles. I feel like, okay, now I'm just,
definitely. It's interesting that there has been some of a revival of that, and why it's an interesting question, and you're right, it's one that I don't really talk about in the book, and I try to actually consciously to avoid kind of talking about this frame of like population as a problem for the problem of environment and climate, and I try to focus much more on kind of capitalist dynamics and production and some of these things and how those have, how those extend beyond sort of what we think of as like traditional production, but to not frame it very consciously in that kind of, Malthusian register that I think is very common in, or has been very common in environmentalism. And I think, I think that's kind of why it's reemerged, just 'cause it's an available frame for people, right? Like it's something people, even people who I think are critical or skeptical of that position, it's like an available way of thinking about one's own action. I think it also comes out of more generally the kind of consumption-oriented frame of environmental and climate politics, where the so much of the conversation is oriented around one's like carbon footprint over sort of your own decisions and sort of choices, whether those be, you know, at the level of, you know, what you sort of eat, what you, you know, whether you're flying, what you're sort of, you know, buying, consumer purchases mostly, but I think children end up factoring into that conversation as sort of basically another like consumption lifestyle choice, yeah. Which is like a ludicrous way to think about, you know, like sort of kids in general, but I think also in terms of like how and why people make these decisions and, you know, it's just, I think it's a very limited frame, no matter what the sort of, you know, consumption is, but, especially I think impoverished when we're thinking about something like, you know, reproduction and having children. So those are, that's why I think it's reemerged. But yeah, I did try to, you know, both to avoid population as like the frame and, you know, not, in some ways, like not even refuting it so much as just saying like, this is not relevant, you know, but also consumption. And there are other, you know, some chapters where I try to say more of a, like, we need to shift away from consumption towards these other ways of thinking about what's going on here. So, you know, I think that would be, you know, I guess that's why I don't address it head on, but I also appreciate the people who have pushed back on it. So I agree with you there.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm gonna try not to pick up. I have too many thoughts about consumption, so I'm gonna bring us, and by us I mean me, back to this term free gift. I mean, if I'm understanding the book correctly, there's really some pretty strange. There's a strange ideological contradiction, according to you, hiding in the phrase free gift, which if you're not familiar with this phrase, listeners, free gift is it's a econo-environmental term, right? It's this idea, yeah, that there is this world out there that is given to us freely, a free gift, and then we do our labor or capitalism or whatever we do. But actually the term free gift, it should just be gift. So the fact that it's free gift means there's more to it. So can you, if I'm understanding, can you unpack this free gift and how it's not really free?
Totally. Yeah. So yeah, the free gift is a really interesting concept, and it's one that I actually, you know, I get from that goes way back in the history of political economic thought. Like, you see, I mean, the idea that nature is a gift from God is a very old one in Western political thought. You know, you see it in people like John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you know, all of these different thinkers talk about sort of the gift of nature from God and things like that. And it's, you know, that the world is given to human beings and so on. And there are a lot of different ways people talk about that. But in a lot of classical political economy, you know, you look at like a David Ricardo or Adam Smith a little bit, Jean-Baptiste Say, these different people who are writing in like the early 19th century mostly, you know, they talk about these gifts that give gratuitously to production in particular. Like, they're talking about the gifts of nature in the specifically economic context and the way that nature does all this work, you know, freely, gratuitously. You know, nature gives these free gifts to production and, you know, there's a little bit of a critique from that Marx makes of that I kind of try to pick up and like run with more, because I think it's been really underdeveloped as a concept of this idea. Like, what does it mean to call something a free gift? I think it is quite, you know, as you say, there's this interesting like contradiction in it, because gifts, you know, are on the one hand, they are kind of like obviously free. Like, you don't buy a gift. Like, you buy a gift for someone, but then you give it to them. You know, it's not a sort of commodity exchange transaction. It's often been seen as sort of like an alternative to the commodity form, because a gift is like a gift exchange. It's like sort of this other way of relating to other people. But it's also supposed to be very reciprocal. Gifts are supposed to be something, you know, you give someone a gift and then they have some kind of reciprocal obligation to you, or they give you a gift back, or whatever it may be. And I think this is interesting, because I don't think this is what the free gift of nature is, really. Like, it's not reciprocal. We're not giving back. We're not giving back to nature. We're taking these gifts that are sort of freely available, that are available without cost and without like sort of a price on them, without going through a kind of traditional commodity exchange where, you know, you exchange money for the thing. That's not happening, right? But I think that's significant, because you know, that is what capitalism is. It's a system oriented, you know, predominantly around commodity exchange. Commodity exchange becomes the way that people interact and like get the things they need and so on. And so then it becomes It becomes weird in such a system that something is free, that you can just get something for free without you know, sort of exchanging money for it. And so the free, I think, becomes extra significant. It sort of signifies like we're in that the sort of unusualness of that is that it's sort of this like counter, it's like the alternative to the commodity, but fully within capitalism. And of course, then, you know, on the one hand, yeah, there are a lot of gifts of nature that give freely in the sense that nobody has to pay for them. But they're obviously not free in the sense of kind of costless once we start thinking about ecological costs, social costs, forms of what we can talk about is basically like harm that don't show up in the sort of like economic terms of like monetary value and so on, but which are like quite substantial. And so there's, that's a whole sort of other dimension of that there are real costs. They just aren't, they appear in like physical terms, right? They appear in biophysical terms. They appear in terms of, harms to health or destruction of ecosystems or things like that, and not in the kind of monetary terms that like the market can see.
Yeah, and then the obvious thing, and this comes up a few times in your book, there's the funny story about Biosphere 2, but just the idea of, and I mean, look, I would rather have there been a carbon tax in the 90s than the just literally nothing that we've done over the past 40 years or so. But this idea that there's this thing, there's an economic term called negative externalities, which mm-hmm. is basically to say that you can, you know, when an ecosystem is being destroyed, you can tally up how much monetary damage is being done to that ecosystem and charge it to the corporation that's doing that monetary damage. And somehow, I'm not exactly sure how, somehow this is supposed to solve the problem of the destruction of the environment. So when you're talking to these people who are just like, well, the problem is we just haven't tallied up how much oak trees are worth. And we just need to charge people the true cost of deforesting North America. How do you even make sense of that perspective with what you're trying to talk about?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there are so many different ways that I think people have basically re-described the problem of the free gift. So the negative externality is one, or it's like in the kind of more mainstream economics framework where it's, you know, the idea that there are all these effects of economic activity that are sort of not being counted or reflected in economic terms. And those are can be negative or positive and so on. And so, yeah, there has been like this very, and so I talk about like natural capital and ecosystem services are the terms that people often use to describe these kinds of like gifts of nature that aren't being economically valued. And there has been now, I mean, it's been interesting because I think, you know, the sort of idea that we should put a price on nature to save it, or that somehow like calculate the value of ecosystems that are like people recognize are doing all of this important work, but that's not being reflected or valued, has been around for a very long time now. You know, it's been like 50 years or so since this idea came, emerged and kind of became, has become increasingly mainstream since. And for the past 20 or 30, especially every like 10 years or so, there's like a big burst of enthusiasm around it. Like, it's like, oh, you know, what we really need to do is just value natural capital, value ecosystem services. More recently, it's been nature as an asset class is the way that people sometimes talk about it. But just like there's this like new realization that this is a problem. It's like not good that, you know, forests are absorbing carbon and we're just chopping them down because that's completely economically like valueless. And it's striking to me because I think there's been like every time it happens, there's sort of the same debate, which is like some group of people, you know, if you read the Financial Times today, like there'll be like a sort of article like this, like every couple of weeks or so. It's like, we just need to put a price on nature. And like, why don't we do this? And, there's all these problems with doing it, but we should just like find a way to calculate like, you know, whatever. Yeah. What the ecological worth and maybe even moral or spiritual value, you know, economists have come up with all these ways to literally say like, well, this is like what, you know, this is like the value of carbon sequestration, but also this is like how important it is to people, the beauty of the ocean or the whatever it may be. Like, They've come up with all these ways to try to like assess these in economic terms. And some of them are pretty ludicrous. You know, like they talk in the book about the study that valued the entire like population of whales on Earth at like, I think, $2 trillion. You know, so like for like every whale that exists, and like that's like less than market or than like Apple is valued at, you know. So it's just kind of, and it just ends up with these kind of things that seem like completely absurd. Or they value the entire biosphere. Like, how much is the entire biosphere worth? Like, you know, there was this very famous paper in 1997 that says the whole biosphere is worth $33 trillion. And you're like, okay, like, but there's literally nothing without that. Like, it's like absurd.
Did they remember to adjust for inflation? So do we know what the biosphere
is? They did readjust it like 10 years later, and it came up with $125 trillion the next time. And they probably have redone it since then. I'm not sure what the most recent one is. But, you know, so they do readjust and like for probably for inflation, for like some other, I don't know, whatever. They've like got some new studies. So and so it is like pretty like laughable, because of course, like how could you put a price on the whole Earth? Like, it's like, who could buy the, you know, it's like a crazy idea. But I also think it's like,
yeah, one of them will want to be buying the Earth or something. Sorry. I mean, I just feel, yeah. I feel like Musk or Bezos will like make a $133 trillion offer for the Earth or something if we give them this valuation. Sorry.
They probably would. But the thing is that I think that like there is something revealing about these, because a lot of the critique has been, you know, either that there's something morally wrong with this, which I think, you know, often think is compelling, or that there's like, it will make it possible to buy these things. And that will sort of, you know, will privatize the entire Earth. But the thing is that it's actually been very, very, like, I guess I try to shift the frame a little bit, because I think a lot of the moral critics are like very, you know, like right. Like, it's like really, it's like something disgusting about being like all of the whales on Earth are worth like this, like not very much money, you know, whatever. And it's like repugnant in a way. But I think the real thing that's that you see when you look at this is like, it just hasn't happened over. They've been trying and trying, or like they keep talking about it. And that, you know, ecosystem services remain valueless. Like, you know, like the biosphere, we continue to treat like a like basically like freely available gift. And it turns out to be actually very hard to make sort of like attach prices to and to commodify a lot of what makes our world work. You know, that commodification like does keep hitting these limits of you know, that the problem basically I would say is like not that everything is being commodifying and brought within the orbit of a sort of capitalism in that sense, but rather that it's just kind of being eroded because it's not a commodity. It's a free gift and it remains a free gift. And so then it doesn't count for anything in this broader system where the only measure of value is in commodity exchange. And so, so I think it's like, you know, there's a way that I think sometimes when we talk about and I think actually even in some of the, if you look at some of these papers that are like, yeah, put a $33 trillion, you know, whatever price tag on the Earth, like, I think of them as actually being kind of like a wages for housework type move. Like, they're supposed to show that this is really valuable stuff that's being unvalued. And they say later, well, we didn't really mean to like, we don't think you should buy the whole Earth. That is crazy. It's like they say it's an awareness raising exercise, right? And so it is kind of like the like wages for housework demand. Like the point is to say, like, look at all of this that's happening. Like this is we are trying to disclose something about capitalism, about the sort of worth of this work, all of these things, so we can kind of change the relationship there. I mean, they don't intend it to be as radical a project. They don't have like a real politics behind it, but I think that sort of the impulse is that move to sort of like show people what is so important about these ecosystems. Unfortunately, that just like has not worked at all. And it hasn't been attached to a very like, you know, to like a real radical political project that could sort of make those demands in the context of like a movement or something like that. So I think it's like trying to say, well, you know, what's going on here? Like, why is it so hard to value some gifts of nature? And actually, like, maybe something else is going on in capitalism than we thought.
Yeah, I mean, I was as you were talking about the fact that it never works. I was just thinking, like, not valuing nature is just sort of the key point. I mean, that's just such a crucial aspect of capitalism. But I was also thinking, you know, there was a wonderful passage in Yanis Varoufakis's new book, where he talks about, you know, describing capitalism to his father, and he says basically like, and he's, you know, he's doing a reading of Marx, and he says, you know, the labor that a worker does, the labor that the capitalist or that the employer is purchasing in a sort of like work to rule, or, you know, within like the framework of the contract, isn't enough. It wouldn't be good enough. In fact, it's the spark of creativity and drive and love that the worker puts into the work that the capitalist extracts as profit, even as the capitalist claims that this thing does not exist. This thing, this spark has no value. And so it seems that there's really very little difference between how labor functions and how nature functions. It's this thing that the capitalist claims they are valuing. And I mean that both like they've assigned a dollar number to it, but in fact, the dollar number they've assigned to it is always off from the actual thing that becomes almost, I mean, I'm getting like metaphysical here. It's almost like ineffable. It's almost, you know, it's almost magical. The actual work that the worker does, in the same way the actual work that the pollinators do, to capture it is impossible, right? I mean, does that connection make sense?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think there's like two things that I think of in relation to that. And one is that, you know, Marx literally talks about human social labor and human cooperation as a gift of nature, like that this is basically, you know, kind of this thing where, as you know, as people come to, you know, they work more collectively, more collaboratively, they sort of generate, you know, more than the sum of their parts in a way, that they are able to sort of do more. That's something about social labor, about this kind of these forms of collective and coordinated work, that people are able to do more than they are when they're sort of working individually or even sort of like small scale cooperative ways, and that this like unleashes these sorts of new human capacities. And he says, you know, capital basically like appropriates this and benefits from this gift of human cooperation that is generated by sort of like, you know, interhuman subjectivity and so on. And so it is literally a version of the free gift, I think. That kind of capacity to work together and to kind of like, yeah, unleash something that is like beyond any kind of like, you know, like kind of separated out, like this is what this one contribution is or whatever. And so so I think there is a way that it's very literally, it is a gift of nature almost. But then I also think in general, like one of the things I really, I think is really important and try to emphasize in the book is just exactly what you're saying, that like, the way that that something like the wage does not value labor as we think it ought to value labor, like that like prices do not represent like the worth of things in the way that we might think that like moral or ethical value exists, and that we need to like constantly interrogate and identify the gap between like the price of something, including the price of labor and like the wage of labor, and what that work is really worth. And that actually like these places, there's some places where it's really apparent. And I think reproductive labor is one of them, where there's like, how is this labor so incredibly socially valuable, but like completely economically unvalued in many ways? That becomes like very, people I think can really get that because they see that gap really clearly. And I think that the gift of nature is sort of the ways that these like very, these essential ecosystemic processes are also not valued is another one where we can see that gap really clearly. But then the thing I want, you know, I think we need to do is sort of to do what you've just said, is like reapply, like remember that gap is always there and go back and look at like what we think of as like normal wage labor, which I think there is a tendency sometimes to think that, you know, like people are paid what their work is worth, or that the wage is a real reflection of certain kinds of labor, even if not all. And say, actually, no, it never is. That's not what wages are. That's not what they do. It's not what prices reflect. They are, you know, that if we want to think about what we think, you know, actually the actual value or contribution of these things are to our sort of like desired social world, we should not be looking at what they're being paid, and that that can maybe like kind of open up a critique of capitalism and capital's value more broadly.
Yeah, to continue on this train of thought, I was thinking as you were talking that sort of this disconnect that you described in your book, and we've already talked about, between like what nature is supposedly worth if you're trying to count it up in dollars, and if we could just, you know, capture that value, it would help. I mean, this is the solution to the problem that wage can't capture work. The capitalist or neoliberal solution is that everyone can be an entrepreneur, everyone can own themselves, everyone can be a miniature corporation. And once you are, you know, your own boss, maybe in some sort of Hayekian way, like you're always going to get exactly what you are truly worth. Like the argument would be, if we just capitalismed a little harder, there would be some sort of self-correcting thermostatic mechanism by which everyone's labor and the natural world would be truly valued correctly. And that is just a fucking nonsense fantasy. We know it's a fantasy in human labor, and it's just a fantasy also with the natural world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is really well put, and it is... I do think that's very much part of this vision of that kind of, you know, again, like incorporating ecosystems into the price system, like putting prices on everything, kind of assigning property rights in every element of nature, in pollution, and like all of these kinds of things. And it does become pretty ludicrous. Like, again, like it's like this idea that you could somehow, you know, capture the entirety of our planet, you know, like all of these processes, some of which we don't even understand or know exist, and that those could all somehow be kind of integrated into a system of price where there's like almost like a one-to-one of like, you know, prices to like carbon molecules. You know, it's like, it is actually like really, it's like utopian and like in a pejorative way, right? Where it's like this idea that is like completely, it's not, you know, it's like not actually plausible at all. It's like a really, you know, even leaving aside the desirability, which I also think it's undesirable for many reasons, but it's like actually not conceivable. And for it to work would also, you know, I think the other thing is for it to work would require an unbelievable amount of like state action and intervention. So even the kind of idea that like the market could just kind of do this and self-correct is really a fantasy, because, you know, I mean, markets, carbon markets, for instance, like which are the only ones that have kind of come to exist, and even they're only barely, and like they're pretty dysfunctional, but like, you know, they have required so much, like they have been fully constructed by the state. And, you know, markets always have some state component, but like, you know, like I can kind of pick an apple and say, like, do you want to buy this? And you can just give me some money. You know, like there are other kinds of goods and commodities that are the basic process of exchange is like fairly straightforward, but like a carbon molecule, you cannot just like pick up like a carbon, you know, you have to assess like the number of carbon, the amount of carbon that's being emitted, and sort of issue credits in it, and like have, it's like a very complicated labyrinthine system. And so at this point, at some point you're like, why would we use the state to construct this like, you know, unbelievably complicated and like overwhelming system of, to like make everything integrate into the market? Like, why would that be the best way forward? Even if you didn't have a critique also of the ways that I think, then we think about markets and sort of like the power relations that obtain within markets and within class societies, that like, you know, again, the sort of that do structure, the cost of things and, but certainly of human labor, but I think also of like what people are willing to tolerate in terms of pollution levels and things like that, that, you know, it's never going to be like an apolitical value. It's going to be always informed by these sorts of social, relations that I do think are like fundamental to capitalism as a system. But, you know, even if, so like there's both this like level in which I think it's like normatively very bad, but also just like completely, it will not happen. So,
yeah, I mean, I think utopian is the right word, and that's something. I mean, I endlessly have arguments with people about Hayek, because I read Hayek and I'm just like, this this sounds great. I want to live in the world that Hayek describes. And so the people who, you know, or maybe they're just older, they've hated Hayek for longer than me, and they know that to be, you know, to like Hayek is to like Thatcher and Pinochet. And I think your critiques of Hayek in this book are dead on. But I just want to say there's this Hayek, and, you know, when Jonathan Ray wrote about Hayek, he described him as like, you know, he could have been an anarchist, you know, like yeah. He ended up an authoritarian. But if you take Hayek's ideas, then it's like, oh yeah, everyone can just get what they're truly worth and be free and make their choices. And I have conversations with progressives and they're just like, this is fucking terrible. And I'm like, no, this is great. The world he's describing is great. The yeah. problem is it does not exist, and contracts and capitalism will not bring it about. And that's what yeah. I think people can't understand. If you don't read yeah. Hayek. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I actually totally agree with you. Like, I think, Hayek is so, you know, like there's a lot of like, you know, complicated things around Hayek, but I actually agree with that basic impulse, which is why I'm like almost trying to recover, not Hayek, but like I have this, you know, one of the arguments is like, that we should recover like this kind of idea of like freedom of choice as like a value of the left, and like I try to do that through Sartre and existentialism. But I do think there's something very compelling about this idea that like, I mean, both that you that your choices, your freely made choices are matter, like they reflect something very fundamental about, you know, what you want in your life, and these things that Hayek says that you should kind of be free to make the decisions about like your commitments in your life and things like that. I find very compelling and I think are true. I do think the problem is both that, you know, is well, I think the problem is like the, both the utopianism versus view of the market, but also the ways that the market, I think actually very limits our ability to make those decisions in real ways. Like, I think it's actually very hard to make, choices in the market that reflect, you know, that kind of reflect one's broader commitments or choices about what the world you want to live in are, other than beyond the kind of very, very basic level of like, I want to consume X or Y good. And so there's something that I think I try to kind of use almost like Hayek against Hayek, or like kind mm-hmm. of the like, you know, this like this impulse that I find compelling, and say like, well, I don't think that markets can deliver this even on yes. even what you say you want. So how can we like, is there a way to recover some of that and point it in a different direction? And I, you know, I do think, I hope there is, and, you know, try to sort of to say why I think that's valuable. But I also, it's also interesting because even Hayek, like, is in some ways less of a fault, you know, like, even Hayek will say things like, well, yeah, I guess, like, maybe the state needs to, like, deal with these problems of like sometimes of pollution or like of like deforestation that's really like from like certain kinds of agriculture. Like he'll actually kind of, he like hates the state, but occasionally he's like, the market's not very good at this thing. Maybe the state needs to come in. And then some of these little instances are like, they're very aside. Like he doesn't go into this little detail. It's like a little aside somewhere, but those instances turn out to be like, actually like when we're thinking on the level of something like climate change or like biodiversity loss or things that are like planetary ecosystemic crises, actually are like a wedge into like much, much more of a kind of role for a, whether it's a state or some kind of like collectively, you know, functioning body than like Hayek would permit. And, you know, he basically recognizes that there are some limits to the market that then later thinkers actually go beyond Hayek even. There's some like neoliberal ecology people who I think are like, no, you know, property rights all the way down and the market can solve it all the way down. But Hayek himself is kind of like, maybe not. So that's, I think, quite interesting.
Yeah. Hayek says, you know, you can have kind of a welfare state. You just got to be careful that it doesn't become serfdom. Hayek, you know, that's why there's this hilarious phrase, yeah. Hayekian socialism, which is yeah. which is a right-wing claim about Hayek, that Hayek left too much room in. And yeah, that's silly that Hayek left too much room in the state, but this too much room for the state. But this yeah. idea that he values freedom of choice and people should be able to make their own decisions. And then, I mean, it's very simple. I'm sure I've said this on the podcast before. Basically, if you have an employer as far as Hayek is concerned, you lose all of that freedom of choice, and that's just fine because you chose to work for that employer, and that's what the market says. And that's nonsense.
Yeah,
that's why Hayek is not very useful, but he's not. He does not need to be completely repudiated because, I think Jonathan Ray says, like, small is beautiful would be a decent slogan for Hayek. And small is beautiful is a nice, good left-wing slogan.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of Hayek as a small is beautiful, but I think that's probably right. So,
I mean, I don't know. Or rather, another way of putting it is small is beautiful, but if non-state forces create a giant agglomeration of power, that's fine too. That's the problem.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Giant forces of power that are state agglomerated are bad for Hayek, but if non-state power does, it's like, what did you want from me? You had freedom and you used it badly.
And you chose it to produce that in some way. No, it's true. And then he does. I mean, I think some of his, there's some, you know, ways that he is quite socially conservative also, where he thinks these are kind of chosen institutions, like, I don't know, like family and sort of social forms of social, like non-contractual, moral and social institutions are somehow like just chosen in a way that I think is quite naive. he could probably use a little more of like a critical perspective on some of those, and those end up doing a lot of work for him in ways, I think. So, you know, he's very like, you know, free choice when it comes to the market, but then sort of assumes that choices are freely made in a bunch of areas that I think a, you know, critical social sort of scientist, social theorist would have a lot more questions about. But we can definitely, I think I'm here for like two cheers for Hayek or something, you know, one cheer for Hayek.
One cheer. Yeah, that sounds good. So I just need to ask about Marx and his relation to nature. I'm no fan of Marx, as everyone who listens to this podcast know. I mean, it's not that I disagree with his broad sweep that, you know, capitalism is bad, etc. Obviously, I hate his theological view of history, and everyone from Ken Stanley Robinson and everyone else explained to me that I'm wrong about his theological view of history, but I'm going to continue being wrong about it. But the other thing that I think, according to you, I'm wrong about is that I have always viewed Marx as, you know, glorifying in the domination of nature by the bourgeois, and he is just excited for the working classes to do that same domination. And then I was just explaining to my students that, I don't know if you know the South Park meme, that's like step one, steal the socks, step two, question mark, step three, profit. I read Marx as like step one, subjugate nature really hard. And two, question mark, step three, stateless utopia. And so this claim that I'm sure he makes here and there that we shouldn't subjugate nature, and also he claims that we shouldn't have a state and all this stuff. All that stuff seems to me in the question mark.
Yeah, part. Totally.
And
totally.
The one part seems to be really like, make a shit ton of factories and mine all of the coal and steel. So am I wrong about this with Marx?
I think I would say, I don't think you're totally wrong. I think that I think Marx is maybe not as full blown, you know, kind of Promethean as people often read him to be. You know, there've been a lot of debates in eco-Marxist thought over the past like few years about this. Some people like John Bellamy Foster and Kohei Saito have done a lot of important work to like find all of these places where Marx talks about, you know, has a much more, you know, what we'd think of as like proto-ecological view, where he cares, he's concerned about like the loss of soil fertility or sort of the these kinds of ways that this really intensive production is ecologically destructive. And I think those people have done really important work to show a kind of another side of Marx on ecology. I also think a lot of the stuff that you described is still there. There still is a kind of like, you know, the bourgeoisie has subjugated the forces of nature, and this is like kind of unleashed new possibilities and blah, blah, blah. And like, I don't think he's like a fully, you know, I would disagree, you know, like Kohei Saito now says, well, Marx is a degrowth communist. And I was like, I don't know about that. Like, I think there's like a lot to, you know, to support the more traditional reading of him as sort of like, you need to develop the forces of production and so on. And I think, you know, I think even there, he's, maybe not as, I think some of the, there's sort of like what Marx says, and there's a way that like Marxist projects and socialist projects have taken up some of that in reality, which I think also diverges some. But in any case, that's sort of, in some ways, like I try to avoid those debates. Like I'm like, well, I don't know if it matters. Like, I don't think that the way we need to think about like capitalism and ecology or capitalism in nature is by saying like, what did Marx say? I do love Marx. I'm like a huge Marx like reader fan. I find Marx incredibly useful, but I don't think that that means like going to him and being like, oh, well, Marx said this about nature, and that means that that is correct, or like that's what the eco-socialist program is. And I sometimes find it a bit baffling when people just want to kind of like constantly do this like exegesis, argue like, what did Marx really say? Like, I don't know, like maybe that's helpful, but it's only really helpful if it helps us understand like how capitalism is treating nature. And so I actually try to kind of just like bracket some of that stuff and say like, well, you know, it's not so much what he says about like ecology. It's what does he, how can we use the way he analyzes and thinks about the commodity and like sort of the core features of capitalism, the commodity and like human labor and these things, like how do we look at basically the flip side of those? And like, which would be in my view, the free gift of nature as a kind of like flip of the commodity, or like the inverse of the commodity in a way. And can we use that kind of method of trying to understand like what the commodity is, like how it operates in capitalism, how human labor, why human labor is valued the way it is. If we apply those questions and tools to thinking about nature and nature's lack of value, like where do we get? And so it really is more of like a Marxist method than Marxist sort of substantive argument. Cause I think we do hit limits there. You know, and for, I think many of the reasons that you've just described, like there's like both, you know, I think there's partly it's just like contradictory things, but also it's just like, it doesn't, at the end of the day, like, you know, I think we should read Marx for trying to understand our world rather than to get like the like slogan or like the program directly from somebody who was thinking at a very different time. And in some ways, like, I think I started off being much more skeptical of like the usefulness of Marx in thinking about like climate and ecology for all of these reasons. I was like, well, can we really use Marx to like kind of understand like climate change or ecology? And you know, can we, is there a direct thing? No, but I have found, I still think he's just like the most powerful way to understand capitalism. And if we think capitalism is at the heart of the climate crisis and broader ecological biodiversity, et cetera, crisis, then I do think we need to, you know, figure out how to like use Marx and maybe unexpected ways to kind of get at that.
Yeah, that all makes sense. Sorry, I was thinking about whether I was going to pick at it more, but you know, you've made clear that that's not something, you know, not something that we need to do. I mean, I guess I'll just say, and I'm sorry, this is the anarchists have been saying this since before they were anarchists. You know, when you look at the world that Marx wants, the post, you know, revolutionary world, it's, you know, it sounds great. It's the same one Kropotkin wants. It's the same one Oscar Wilde wants. It's the same one Hayek wants. It's probably the same one Keynes wants. You know, everybody wants to live past violence and hierarchy and coercion and capitalism and factories without going like full William Morris and everyone having to work really hard, you know, growing their food. That's what everyone wants. And it just seems like it is always that question mark. No one thinks, I mean, you have to be like an out and out fascist to say, we want a world of hierarchy, coercion, factories, militaries, imperialism forever. No one says they want that forever. It's just how one gets to this, you know, Hobsbawm calls it a gentle anarchy. Mm-hmm. How one gets to this gentle anarchy that seems to be the same that you know, Keynes and Oscar Wilde and Marx and Hayek all want. That seems to be the really important part, because otherwise, if you're saying all those people have roughly the same ideas, and they do in terms of the fruit at the end of their telos, then that actually you're not saying much. If you put all those people together, then whatever you're doing is something as mushy as like love is good or something like that. That's too mushy. And I'm just, I don't know. I'm going to continue being skeptical that the the man I still view as the prophet of, you know, industrial capitalism is going to value nature in a way that I would like. God damn it, I used the word value, which I was trying to avoid using.
It's a tough word. Yeah, it's both value and nature. I feel like real struggles. I'm always like, wow, these are both like really tough, like, you know, impossible to use clearly and also, you know, unavoidable in some way. So
sure. I mean, Emerson's definition of nature is everything that is not you know, and so my students get so mad about this. And I'm like, well, you know, you see what he means, but like, then if like, you know, the Empire State Building is nature, I mean, that both makes sense and doesn't make sense. And then you can, as I have done before,
totally.
75 minutes with undergraduates arguing about whether or not concrete buildings are nature or not.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, it doesn't get anywhere except it gets the undergraduates happy that they wasted 75 minutes.
I feel like I had some great conversations about whether like New York City is nature or not. Like reading like, I don't know if you're like Steve Vogel's like Thinking Like a Mall, but like, going full Thinking Like a Mall, and they're all like, whoa. So I feel like we have a lot of fun with that one, but.
it's super fun, but it doesn't, I don't know. I just wanted to like sort of put my foot down and be like, yes, you can play these games, but you know that there's a difference between a forest and a mall. And you know, when someone says nature, they're talking about the forest. And I think
that's true. But I think they're important because I think a lot of, ecological thought assumes that we know what nature is and that nature is good. And I don't think we should assume that nature is like a normative value. Like, I actually just think we have to question that and be like, which natures and why? And like, you know, because like otherwise we just are doing full deep ecology, which like is a position that you could defend, but you would have to defend it. And I'm not a deep ecologist. I don't think that we should just, you know, say like nature, preserving nature in a state that we have. And even that, preserving nature is like, what is that? You know, like all of ecology is about interactions with, you know, between beings and species. And so at some point it's like, which kinds of interventions are bad and why? And I think that's a hard question to answer. And if you have an idea of just like nature is just kind of morally significant, but unclear why exactly or which ones, like then it's very hard to make real, you know, kind of political choices or commitments.
Yeah. Willa Cather has this wonderful line about Walt Whitman. I'm going to get it wrong, but she says something like, everyone calls him like, you know, the great good poet or something like that. And it's like, Walt Whitman, he celebrated everything, and he literally celebrated everything. So like, you can't look at him. He celebrated the natural world, which is to say everything that was good, everything that was bad. He celebrated nature. He celebrated the destruction of nature. He is against racism. He is for racism. He's just like, it's just all there. That was his project of just, it's all there. And so when you try and take Whitman and make him, as you say, normative, like we want to celebrate what Whitman celebrated, it's like, no, that's nothing. That's just saying the world exists, which is in some Zen way true and powerful, but if you're actually trying to come up with a political program that will make the world a better place, nature is good and should be preserved. It's again about the same as saying life is beautiful or something like that. It's not gonna get you anywhere.
I totally agree. Yeah.
This is my, you know, sort of rough Jamesian pragmatism. You know, it's not going to get you anywhere. Like, life is beautiful. Great. Congratulations. We all agree.
Yeah. Hey,
love is good. Respect nature. Okay, fine.
Totally agree.
All right. So I'm blathering and we've talked for a while. So what else do we need to cover, Alyssa, before we go?
Maybe I guess one thing I would just say, like on the, to just pick up on the last thing we were talking about, kind of like, what is the end goal or something? In a lot of ways, like, you know, I think I try to leave that really open in the book, like that, like, it's not like, it really doesn't have a vision. It's not like the ultimate, like, like laying out what the eco-socialist program would be, or the eco-socialist society, or the like happy life is beautiful, nature is good, whatever, no coercion, hierarchy, domination. I mean, I think all those things too, but like what that looks like. You know, I do think really ought to be a sort of the question, like that feels to me like very much the question before us, like what is the world we want to live in? And like, how do we sort of like envision like a world that is like, you know, reasonably ecologically sustainable and respectful of nature, but also like doing the things that human, you know, the things that we value about like human life and societies that is, that are sometimes like, you know, destructive of nature. Like, how do we sort of think about those? And I think those are like the most important questions we have to answer. And, you know, a lot of it is just about like how capitalism makes it almost impossible to make those decisions and choices in a meaningful way. And so it is, you know, a critique more in that sense, more than kind of like a program. And, you know, I think sometimes people are like, I think it's with like climate, especially, is like, well, we need like a program. We need a vision. I do think we need those things and try to do that and other stuff. But I just feel like really recognizing the ways that we will like, are really fundamentally limited. And to go back to the theme of freedom, that we are our freedom to make those real choices and commitments. And again, like a freedom of choice about like what the end goal is, what the world we want to live in is, you know, is not enabled by, but limited by capitalism is really important. And then, you know, then the real interesting problems start, I think, you know, like when we're no longer kind of like compelled by like needing to like labor and produce and sort of generate value and all of these things. Then we have like a bunch more interesting questions on the table. but right now I feel like most of those are sort of, they're questions that you can argue about in moral philosophy, but they, as you say, don't get us anywhere.
Yeah. And the road that people are most likely to want to go down when you say we need to talk about valuing nature is precisely the one that we started with. I think maybe we spent the most time on this neoliberal, let's slap a dollar sign on it. And I think you've done an excellent job of showing that. I mean, really, how absurd that can be, honestly.
Thank you.
I mean, I think this is great. I think this is good for me. Any final words?
Nothing I can think of. Yeah, it's been really fun to talk.
Right. We did a good job then. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much.